Many local people are familiar with Chinese lifestyle beliefs such as Tai Chi, which explore the realms of inner peace and use meditation and exercise to develop good health and help us live in the world in harmony. No harm in that, you might think, but it's currently a serious issue in China, according to a Chinese team with a visiting art exhibition just opened at Cambridge's Guildhall. Practicing the lifestyle-enhancing art of Falun Gong and engaging in the pop art of Zen Shan Ren, which underpins it, has led to thousands of Chinese people being arrested by police and brutally tortured. The Cambridge audience were shocked to hear university researcher Fengling Zhou's account of how she was arrested, stripped naked, tied to a table by police and brutally abused. I spoke to Jing Wen, a Falun Gong practitioner at the exhibition, who said she also faces being arrested if she goes back to China. How do you practice Falun Gong?
We do exercise and actually, Falun Gong try to improve both mind and body health.
Yeah.
So for body, we do exercise. For mind, so we try to improve our morality. So we read some book. Yeah, mm-hmm.
So it's bringing inner peace,
and various principles involved.
Yeah.
So the Falun Gong focus on truthful compassion and tolerance. So, and I think our world need these three words. We think this is the universe principle. So, and will benefit to everybody, no matter whether you are Chinese or whether you have religion belief. So I think, yeah, from my own experience or from my friends' experience, we all got benefit from
the art here this evening. Seems to be very much a cry for justice, but it's a peaceable cry for justice, isn't it? Because we've heard some testimony here this evening about the terrible abuses that people have suffered at the hands of the state and the police in China who want to practice these beliefs. I was listening. I mean, in the past, people like the Dalai Lama have come to Cambridge and made speeches of this sort about oppression in Tibet. And recently I spoke to a Romanian woman who spoke to Spanish television abroad about the state which she denounced in Romania and was told when she went back she would be arrested. Is there fear among Chinese people who come to places like Cambridge and give a testimony at an exhibition like this and tell of their experiences that they will suffer oppression when they go back to China?
I think now China's situation is even worse than that. For example, every Saturday morning, we protest in front of the King's College. So we give Chinese tourists some
leaflets and things
some
like
leaflets
that.
Or something. But most of them, they are not to accept it. Because if he holds this, go back to custom, go back to China, the Chinese policeman will arrest him. I think for Falun Gong, I think it's one kind of lifestyle or one kind of faith. So I don't think it's
an art form as well as a practice. It does have a political message, doesn't it? I mean,
we regard it as human right. For me, I just want to be a good person, follow this one. But the Communist Party persecute me, so I have to appear or protest. So this is not a political issue. It's a human
spiritual
right.
thing.
It's totally human right. I think for example, we don't want to take over the power of China. We don't want to involve any political. But we only want, we have only one goal, to stop this persecution, to end this persecution.
Yes.
But now, this persecution happened for 12 years.
Now, they're very serious offences that happen against the people who are persecuted. Can you tell me a little bit about the experiences of people who are picked up? Falun Gong practitioner who's been arrested by the police, and this is a painting of her in the police station. Tell me about it.
It's not in police station, it's in her house.
In her house?
In her house, because she still wants to practice. She doesn't want to give up.
Yeah.
So police took
take away all
take
her property.
Away all his property and, And this happened, I think, I don't know how many people we, even from overseas, we have verified, so at least 3,000, more than 3,000 people tortured to death.
Tortured to death.
But how many, you know, Communist Party don't let people have their own thought, have their own idea? You must follow, in China, we must follow Communist Party's thinking way. So no any freedom of speech or any freedom of...
And why do you think the state fears it so much? Why?
Okay, so this is a really good question. I think the only reason, because Communist parties, they always want to control people's mind.
Yeah.
But there are over 1 million Falun Gong practitioners. Falun Gong, yeah. I mean, over 1 million Chinese people. Now they don't follow Communist Party. They want to follow truth for compassion, tolerance. So it's totally different from Communist. So that's why Communist cannot...
They see them as an enemy.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah. They regard it as the first enemy of the station, of the country. Describe this.
Miracles.
Yeah.
I was talking earlier to someone saying that in China, people are capable of the most incredible physical feats in terms of acrobatics and Olympic athletes and Shaolin monks and things like that. But this takes it a step further when you enter into levitation. But isn't it more about the fact that her inner world is more real than theirs?
Oh, yeah.
And you have in this image a policeman who's astonished by the levitation going on in the middle of it as an unbeliever. So it's quite an interesting piece of religious imagery.
Yeah. Policeman, they torture her.
The policeman torture her.
He tortured her.
And her shackle from her ankle has been removed in the image from her bloody ankle.
I think this is really a miracle.
On a lighter note, elsewhere in and around the city of Cambridge, I've been looking at Open Studios in its 30th year. Once again, 240 artists have thrown open their homes, studio workshops and gardens to the public, giving a rare chance to meet them and find out about their techniques, inspirational ideas and their latest works. I found a wide range of painters, potters, jewellers, photographers, glassmakers, printmakers, sculptors and woodcarvers. I took a tour of some of the fascinating exhibits in the sticks and in the city and once again found some stimulating new food for thought. Local sculptor Carol Sinclair showed me around her studio workspace and glorious garden in Hildesheim Village, which has a wide range of interesting exhibits. Recently, she's been working with branch-shaped staves and pieces of wood which have beautifully coloured and polished stones embedded in them, in a curious way lifting them from the concrete natural setting into an abstract one on a white wall, in the way that they're cleaned up and presented as stimulating objects which need closer inspection. It's impossible to see exactly what these objects are, and that's the charm of them, because they're made of materials we're familiar with, and yet fit harmoniously either in a clean exhibition space or in a natural setting of the garden outside. Her smaller pieces all seem to have a regenerative influence, since things appear to be unexpectedly fertile, and have things apparently growing from them as new signs of life. She let me into her world for a few minutes. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the exhibits that you've got in your garden? Because you've got some new work here, but also things that people will recognise from the past. You've got these orb-shaped stone things that look as though they're like a piece of fruit cut in half. How did those come about? And
gosh, I don't know. I suppose the shape is the cement hemisphere is rather like a picture frame.
Mm-hmm.
So I've used that as a frame and used lots of different materials over the years to gin them, to kind of, I don't know, explain my interests or art. Pebbles, copper, all sorts of things.
And you have this wonderful and extremely large grey stone obelisk shape piece like that. What happens when an idea like that comes about? Because it must have taken an extremely large piece of material to make something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically a large chunk of tree, a tree trunk. So I had to think of a shape that would complement that. But it's also a shape that appears in nature as a seed, a cocoon, you know, it's a kind of natural shape.
And how important is it for some of these things to be seen outside rather than inside?
It isn't actually that important. Mm-hmm. I think they work either way. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a really large piece like that would have to be in a very large hall or, you know, an area that had height. Mm-hmm. But I like to think that they more or less will be indoors or outdoors. And some pieces obviously can't go outside if they would deteriorate naturally. Some people don't mind if that happens.
Mm-hmm. And we're looking at in your gallery space here some new items. How does an idea like that come into your head? It's like a very long, interesting piece of wood with lots of circular shaped, different coloured stones embedded into it.
Yeah, the stones I've found on beaches, and I've sometimes stolen them from people's driveways if one takes my fancy. But I'm quite fascinated by the way when one goes to the beach that the general colour is brown until you start to look and take individual pebbles and look at them separately. So it was sort of about that.
It's like sort of things that are discovered in driftwood and then suddenly focusing on what's really there, isn't it?
It interests me the way stones are pushed into crevices of wood and wooden groins on the beach, especially in Norfolk. And the power of the sea locks them into the wood and it's almost impossible to get them out. I just like the sort of ergonomics of...
And these standing large pieces of carved wood, were those things that you found on a beach somewhere, or they look as though they're from a house joist or something like that, originally, or were they
tree cuts? These were actually the offcuts from a piece similar to the one you're talking about. They come from the side of a large cone that I had cut from a tree. So, and I just loved them. I think they were very beautiful. And unplanned, and I rather like that.
Now, you were showing me in your other studio some new work that you produced. Do ideas for pieces of sculpture like this come in batches? You get one thing, and then you just like have a chain of things that go from one idea into several pieces of work.
Yes, but I often go back to ideas and reform them or look at them in a new way. Often, when I'm tidying up the studio, when it gets into such a state that I can't move, and I pile things, sort of put them out of the way. Often I see materials that actually work together rather well, and that will set off an idea of putting them together in some way.
Have you developed like a clear rationale for each set of things? Is there sort of a chain of ideas that we can understand about the art, what you're trying to do with it, what you're hoping it would achieve?
I'm always trying to reach the sublime.
The sublime, yeah.
Anyway, for the piece to give off some kind of very tranquil, relaxed vibe that is redolent of things in life like smells, colours, sounds. They're intangible, but I try. That's what I'm trying to do.
It's a deep, relaxing, kind of peaceful feeling. Yeah.
But it's very close to nature. Mm. Yeah. It's about really sitting in the middle of a field and becoming part of nature rather than apart. Yeah. I'm trying to get that in the work, but I'm not sure if it always works, but sometimes I get feedback that says it's almost there.
And are you planning any other exhibitions later on this year in Cambridge or anywhere else?
This is the last one for a while.
Oh, for a while, yeah.
I've got to get on with some work and do a lot more beach combing and getting into the elements. I mean, I've been working a bit too hard, really. I need to experience the things I'm making work about again.
Does Open Studios give you a good opportunity to get lots of feedback from people who come in and let you see things that perhaps you hadn't thought of in your own work, as it were?
No, I don't find it helpful in that way. I do really enjoy it. It's happened this afternoon when two people had read that I was opening my studio and didn't really know anything about art and then came and enjoyed it. That was really fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And feedback from people, good feedback and bad. I mean, I don't get much bad really, but it's good. It's you know, it's about, it reinforces what you're doing.
If you need inspiration in taking up art later in life, a trip to the studio certainly puts some lead in your pencil. Sculptor Eve Corder made a second career after being an NHS IT specialist when she decided to study an art degree at Anglia Ruskin University and took the surprising departure to work with welding steel objects together, a world usually confined to men and which has its hazards. She's used to arc welding metal objects found from scrapyards and farms and then builds them into curious animals, birds and other forms which work well in gardens. Eve experiments with relationships between one piece of metal and another until an idea comes to her for a figurative or abstract piece.
Now you're working in welded pieces of metal, which are all kinds of objects which come from scrapyards. They're contributed by friends, and you weld them together into these garden sculptures. Can you tell me a little bit about what inspired this in the first place?
Well, I did a degree at Anglia in art and, well, studio art and art history, and having thought I was going to be a famous painter, I discovered that actually the sculpture studio was the place where I felt most at home. And I was asked to do a module on figure sculpture. And the woman who's running the course said I'd be really pleased if someone did some welding. And so I learnt to weld, and I found it rather a magic medium.
It's quite a dramatic way of making art objects, isn't it? Because sparks fly left, right and centre. You know, you have these huge pieces of metal which you put together. It's something that it requires quite a lot of dedication to do, say, you know.
Well, you know, I do rather enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yes, and I love metal. I don't know why. It's something perhaps to do from my past, because my father used to use tools and I used to sit in his workshop and mess around with little bits of wood. So something to do with feeling at home, I think.
Now, you've got you must have 30 or 40 sculptures in your garden at the moment. Can you tell me a little bit about one or two of them, do you think?
Well, I'm looking at the moment at the one called Standing Man, which is a very boring description, but I got a bit sort of short of interesting names for them. And that's made from a gate hinge, which I've stood up on its ends, and then it's got a little bit of a plough sort of shape or digger or something to make it balance. And a piece that I can't remember where it came from, it's one arm, and then there's a shelf hinge for the other arm, which holds onto a rod. So then I've got 3 points, so it's reasonably stable. And then it has a little sort of hat on top to make it, to cheer it along a bit. And then I've had to fix various bolts and things so that I can, so it stays together. Because the worst thing is if you've made a piece of sculpture and then, you know, somebody takes it home and it immediately falls to pieces.
Because they represent all kinds of things, like animals and figures and insects, snakes and ships, all kinds of different things. So that's and you cover them with hammerite paint, is that right?
It's a hammerite curast. It's less than a paint, really. It converts the rust into a black finish, and it lasts about a year. And it means that I don't have to clean the rust off, which is a great thing. And in fact, the rust adds sort of interest to it because it gives it a black, interesting finish.
Mm-hmm. And you also have some paintings in the house.
Yes, well, they're prints, actually. Mm-hmm. My friend Ninette Rubenstein does prints, and I like to have somebody in the house so that there's two of us, because it's more convivial, really, to have two artists in the same studio, and she's hung them in my sitting room, and I think they're lovely.
When it comes to painting, there are a few local artists as well known as Charlotte Cornish, who splashes us with light and colour in a dazzling series of big canvases, which she says are an emotional reaction within her heart and senses to the things she experiences, depicted in combinations of interrelating spirals and abstract shapes, which generate a core feeling reacting to an encounter in the world we know. Another year of Open Studios. You've got lots of new work here. What's it been like this year? How many people have been coming to see you? What have they been saying?
Well, it's been quite nice. There have been quite a lot of people through each day. There's been about 40 to 50 people on each of the 4 days I've now been open. This is my last weekend, so I'm just about to finish this weekend. And it's been great. People are very supportive. I've had some great feedback. A lot of people are returning people who've been before. And so it's nice to see familiar faces.
Now you have very distinctive paintings all around us here, which are a huge amount of colour, but you have a particular approach, don't you, towards your art, which is that they each represent something specific, isn't that right?
Well, I have a sense that what I'm trying to do is describe a bit about what things feel like, rather than just things, obviously what things look like. So my work is, although it has a kind of representational starting point, often from images taken from photographs from places I've visited or travelled to, the actual compositions then develop much more symbolically and become hopefully much more about what it feels like to maybe be in those places and things like that.
So your art basically is an emotional reaction to something that comes from your heart and then it goes onto the canvas.
Yeah, I think probably that is it, yeah. And it's also a response to the visual world as well. But there is a sense that I'm trying to do something, yeah, much more, yeah, emotional.
Now, your paintings are obviously very well known in Cambridge. Lots of people have seen them and liked them. Has your art moved on in recent years or even this year from one phase to another?
I think over the last few years, my work's been very much in a vein. I think I've got a language that I've been working on and developing now for a number of years. But I'd like to think that hopefully the language is becoming more refined or more resolved. I think there's a certain confidence to some of the, for instance, some of the techniques, some of the mark-making techniques I'm using that has come about through years and years of using it.
And how important is it for you as an artist to come straight into contact with the public when you're showing your work in an exhibition?
It's actually really, really important. The rest of the year I work in complete isolation in a studio on my own, and the only time that I do have that direct feedback from people is during open studios or maybe on the private view of an exhibition. The rest of the time the work is exhibited and sold without me being there, so I don't get any direct feedback, and it's actually lovely to get it. But for many years I've been selling both my paintings and my limited edition prints through Cambridge Contemporary Art on Trinity Street. Just recently I've actually had a new arrangement where Cambridge Contemporary Art will exclusively have my limited edition work, and Bayard Art on King's Parade are going to start dealing with me with some of my paintings. So I'm actually going to a couple of art fairs with them in the autumn, and hopefully some work will be coming into their gallery towards the end of the year.
And any of those places will signpost on the internet where people can find your work?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Or people can contact me directly from my own website, which is just at my name, and then I can certainly happily give information about where work's available.
Now, how has Open Studio has gone down with the arts community this year in Cambridge? What's been what have people been saying about how it's gone? Because it's different each year, isn't
it? It's different each year. I think what's been lovely, the feedback I've had from the people visiting has been very much that people are still very, very keen to go out and look at the art.
Yeah.
I do have a sense that some people are now feeling they're possibly not in a position to buy as much as they have done in recent years, with things being more difficult financially. But certainly the support for going around and looking at the artist's work seems to be the same, which is wonderful.
There's no shortage of interest, and there's lots of new arts venues opening in Cambridge, and it's actually the community is beginning to get more and more busy, isn't it?
It is.
But I suppose for you as an artist, it's important that people do buy, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I think if you're a professional artist, which I am, this is my only income, there is obviously always going to be an importance that the work does eventually sell. What's nice about Open Studios is there's a mixture of artists working. Some are not necessarily relying on it for their full income,
yeah.
And some are, and I think that kind of mixture is also very nice because it makes a range of artworks at different prices available.
A new exhibition has just opened in Kettle's Yard Gallery in Cambridge, which takes a new look at the region's wartime past. Von Ribbentrop in St Ives, Art and War in the Last Resort, looks at how war can inspire unexpected things from people as their lives are thrown into uncertainty and chaos, and an atmosphere of deceit and pretense replaces the flow of normal life. The show was created by painter, author and filmmaker Andrew Lanyon, and it explores the remarkable intersections between art and history in everyday life in St Ives during the Second World War. It's based on a book by Lanyon, and the thread looks at two unconnected stories of the era, that of German ambassador von Ribbentrop's holiday in the 1930s when he was suspected of spying, and also that of an encounter by artists Ben Nicholson and Christopher Wood with the fisherman painter called Alfred Wallace. Abstraction and realism in the interwar years is the main focus, and the use of the imagination for both art and for war. It features paintings, archive materials, films, and interactive models which you pull a string to activate. Andrew Lanyon explains.
The awful point that I make in the show is that in peacetime, pretense is kept alive in the arts. And we actually have a song and a film about this, where nature goes to a play with Pan on her arm, and she's just checking that the pretense is up to standard. Because in wartime, pretense needs to flower as deceit in order to win in wartime. And it's quite interesting, that difference between pretense being kept on the bubble, on the boil, in the arts, in order that, I mean, you see it happening, you see it in the last war, you know, with camouflage, with lots of areas, and, you know, you look at Napoleon's battles, the importance of deceit in war is vital.
Desperate circumstances throw people off in different directions, don't they? Because there's one thing trying to cope with the war and the violence and everything else, but then there's the other thing, which is trying to actually have a life within that.
As anywhere, when war is declared, you begin to worry. And St Ives particularly had a lot of foreign people with the artists down there from 1900 onwards. It was... You had Swedes, Germans, Americans, Australians, extraordinary wide variety of people. And a lot of them came under suspicion. I mean, in the First World War, Frieda and Lawrence had been under suspicion, and probably quite reasonably, because Frieda was the Red Baron's sister, and also they'd been singing patriotic German songs in the Tinner's Arms. So later, people hanging out there washing on the cliffs were suspected of signalling to the submarines in both wars, and that is addressed in the show. And of course, you do get this problem of suspicion about who, you know, who's doing what.
What kind of man was with Ribbentrop?
Ribbentrop was really a lackey. Hitler needed Ribbentrop because he played up to him. Ribbentrop, you can see him being quite scared that others who he knew hated him, like Goebbels and Goering. They said he was trumped up, married money. And there's so many times he rushes back from Britain. He daren't be away from the Fuhrer for more than a month at the most, maybe 2 weeks. He's always on the plane back to Berlin to keep him in favour, because he knows they're scheming to get him out, because he is actually pretty useless. And he takes on board the characteristics of Hitler. He throws fits. Five of his aides, one of them called Fitz, actually write books about how awful he was.
Does it surprise you that some of these people who seem to be capable of incredible acts of inhumanity also seem to be very intellectually savvy people, people with interests, able to appreciate many things in life, and yet at the same time they were aligned with Nazis, effectively?
Well, Spitz is an interesting person. He was one of Ribbentrop's aides who wrote books afterwards. He actually intended to write a book on Third Reich humour, which is very suspect. But he survived the war and came back from hiding in Argentina in the 50s. He'd fallen in love on that Cornish trip with Ribbentrop, who was his boss, with a Cornish girl, and would have married her, always sent her flowers after the war. His story is quite interesting because he wasn't really a bad person. Yes, he allied himself. He's the last person to die who is in Hitler's close circle. And we wrote to him. He lives in some sort of retired home for ex-Nazis in Austria. But we didn't get a reply, and I think he's probably gone gaga anyway.
Mm-hmm. And in those days, was spying a particularly glamorous thing to do socially, to be sort of, you know, somebody who was playing both ends against the middle, you know,
well, it's a bit
taking
like,
risks of that sort?
It's a bit like poetry. It's always intriguing if it's a little bit vague.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot like, you know, like abstract art. You know, it's a lot of these things that aren't very clear-cut, like science has to be, that rogues can be drawn to.
Now there are lots of things in this exhibition which are extremely interesting. I mean, I noticed that you had a piece which was a tiny wardrobe that was representing, you know, Charles' nightmare in the night, with the dark crack in the wardrobe, which is sort of has a subconscious kind of angle to it.
That darkness,
yeah,
that strip of darkness as the cupboard door creaks open to the child is darker than it really is. It's you know, it's darker than any black. It's the power of the imagination. And that's really what's underlying the whole show. It's about accessing the imagination. What is the imagination? In fact, it probably doesn't exist. It's just a memory store. And we build everything that we imagine out of bits that our memory has broken things down into.
Now there are lots of things like images of planes and propellers and machines that are used in war, objects that may have, you know, been more important in war than in peacetime, and so on and so forth. Can you describe some of the things that are actually contained there for people to come and see?
Well, yeah, one good extreme is in Dresden, which was far enough away from our bombers to actually make an awful lot of stuff. particularly the optics, Zeiss. And they were making all the optics for the gun sights and everything. Every killing machine needs a sight. Submarines, airplanes, tanks. And in the show, we've got a little model which is almost probably as complicated to work as a tank, because it's got five ring pulls, I think, or four anyway. And one of them pulls, it's a girl working in the Zeiss Icon munitions optic factory for making sights, and she is etching the cross on the optics. And her lover, the shadow of her lover, passes the window, and she's distracted for a moment and jogs, and the cross is misaligned, and it saves lives.
Saves lives, yeah.
So often extremes are dealt with, where, you know, this wartime awfulness, and then love as well. There's another instance that I use where a pilot who's bombing people in the jungle, and they're fleeing from the villages in the trees, and he drops five bombs, and on the letter in his breast pocket next to his heart is a letter from his lover with five kisses on it.
Very, very, very sort of moving. And also, obviously, lots of these exhibits actually have moving parts in them that the people who come around can just pull a string pull.
Yeah, I was beginning to regret today hearing children in the distance coming towards these ring pulls, and I knew. I mean, after the first time we showed the show, you know, there was just two dozen ring pulls, and a child came up with four of them in its hand. That had been pulled off.
Oh dear. And there's also pieces of film of images of, I saw that there was almost a fantasy image of an elderly man dressed as a conquistador. And
that's Don Quixote.
Don Quixote.
It's really a visual pun on Alfred Wallace, who was very, diminutive and had a long moustache.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And he just, I suddenly realised he looks like Sancho Panza. So I pretend Alfred Wallace is a First World War fighter pilot, shot down over a wood near Madrid. Hmm. And they happen to be filming Don Quixote's 17th descendant, who has been bred to ever leaner, taller females so that he should look more like his great ancestor. And Sancho Panza is shot out of his aeroplane and parachutes down and lands, and this descendant of Cervantes thinks it sounds Chopinza.
Now, what are you hoping people are going to walk away with once they've been through this exhibition, which is extremely exciting at Kettle's Yard? Lots of people enjoying it this evening.
We are discovering a bit more about how one accesses the imagination or the memory store. We're discovering ways. We've been experimenting with making tunes, discovering tunes, as if we were like a nomadic raiding party, really. We just find the tune, capture it, move on to the next. So, for instance, in one day of tune finding, we did 29 songs in one day at an average of 7.5 minutes each. And it's a very exciting way. And the musicians seem to keep coming back. We've got opera singers and jazz singers and very good violinists and so on. I was hoping to do the experiment in Cambridge with people I'd never met, but maybe one day.
And how long is this exhibition going on for now?
It's 2 months.
2 months. Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much indeed.
This edition's art celebrity is the godfather of pop art, Sir Peter Blake, who made an appearance at Cambridge Contemporary Art Gallery to launch a new print exhibition of his work, both old and new, from his long and high-impact career. His best-known work is the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album cover. Gallery director Natalie Staples introduced the exhibition.
This is a really fantastic exhibition. How did it come about, and how did you manage to land someone as famous as Peter Blake for an evening?
I guess it's all to do with connections, really. I've been very lucky. I do know some really lovely people who actually suggested that we should show Peter Blake's work, and fortunate to be able to show his work in the gallery.
Now, he's an artist who's been working since, you know, way back in the 50s, and yet he's still working now and producing fantastic pieces of work.
Well, we're really lucky because we've got works here sort of spanning from the last sort of 6 or 7 years. I see a real sort of diversity in the work. There are some prints which have only just been published in the last couple of months, for example, the homage to Damien Hirst, The Butterfly Man. And then there are some more iconic pieces like the I Love You and Billy Rainbow, which are very sort of reminiscent of his earlier work with a very striking colour. So we've got a really wide range of work here.
So Peter, you're known in the title of this exhibition, at any rate, as the godfather of pop art. How long has pop art actually existed?
It started really in 1954, I would say, so almost 60 years.
And where did the first ideas come from, and how do you... What are the constituent ingredients of a piece of pop art? How do you characterise it?
Well, I think there were three branches of pop art. The kind of American pop art, which was begun by Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns in America. And then there were the other pop artists in England were Richard Hamilton and Eduardo Palazzi. And I was kind of separate. And I think my kind of pop art just came out of being autobiographical. You know, it was about the life I'd led until then, you know, going to professional wrestling as a kid and things like that. I had two shows just before Christmas, one at the Waddington Gallery that was called Homage 10x5, and in that I chose 10 artists and did 5 pieces of work in homage to them, and the other one was called the Museum of Everything. And that was up at Primrose Hill. That was my collection.
And what brings you to Cambridge? What does this exhibition...
Well, this particular one is organised by CCA Prince. And they have shows all around the country. So it's one of their shows. So I also have a show in Bath at the moment at the Holborn Museum called A Museum for Myself, which is part collection, part work.
In the process of making one of these works of art, how long does it take you to get a work visually just right that captures that pop art feeling?
It can be very fast, or it can take 30, I mean, some pictures have taken 30 years, whereas these days I can work on a computer, which I can't do, but I can work with somebody, and I can make a print in a day. You know, I can take the imagery in and actually compose it straight away.
And what are you working on at the moment? Is there a lot of new work coming from you?
Well, I'm always printmaking, so tomorrow I'll be in at Coriander Studios. I'm doing an image of Gorbachev because he's 80 years old, and I'm signing some prints. But the most exciting thing, I'm doing a painting that will go into St Paul's Cathedral. So the Knight Bachelors have a chapel, and I've been commissioned to make a painting of St Martin to go there. So that's what I'm actually working on at the moment.
Now, most people of my generation, you're most famous for the cover of the Sgt Pepper Beatles album.
Yeah.
Was that your heyday during that particular period?
In a way, it's a terrible albatross, you know. But simply to answer your question, not get grumpy, it wasn't the heyday. No, I mean, I suppose, in a way, the early pop art, in the kind of late 50s, early 60s, if there was a heyday, it was then. Sgt Pepper was 67, and by then I was quite established. It was just another job. It was a record cover.
Now, you have a very nice collection of prints here which have feature a lot of butterfly images as a set. Those feelings of elation that came with that whole culture in the 60s, do you think that those are ever really recreated in this era, in the 2000s?
Up to a point. I suppose what I do, there's an ongoing way of working, but every so often I refer back. So there's a set of prints here called Replay, which very consciously takes earlier images and reworks the idea. So there's always a kind of going, so it's kind of two steps forward, one step back. So I'm always looking back and looking forward.
You know. Did you ever envisage at the beginning how universally famous all of these images would become as essential pieces of households all over the world?
I don't think you do, no. No, I think it's... I mean, Sgt Pepper was 67, so that's 40-something years ago, and it's taken its place in art history, really, you know. As is pop art. I mean, pop art as a movement, it takes its place along with... Surrealism and Cubism and all the other movements, you know.
And walking around Cambridge, have you found anything that would inspire you here towards a piece of...
Absolutely, this afternoon, because one of the things I wanted to do was go to Kettle's Yard, which I've never been to. But we arrived quite late, so as we went in, they said you've only got 5 minutes to look around, but we were a bit longer than that. So that's very inspirational.
That's all for this week's Arts Roundup here on Cambridge 105 FM. In the next edition, I'll be looking at life drawing classes at Anglia Ruskin University, sampling an exciting new venue in the city, and visiting the Fitzwilliam Museum to talk about some masterpiece paintings. I'm Simon Burton, and I hope you enjoyed the Arts Roundup Hour.